Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which brews beers that are highly rated by beer critics and beer lovers alike. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions, and later on in the show, we're going to dig deep into the influential German art rock genre known as Krautrock. Late 60s, early 70s, these German innovators laid the foundation for several genres of music, Jim.
Of modern music, yes.
Everything from independent rock music to hip-hop and techno. We're going to explore where that all came from.
But first, we have some music news. Greg, you wrote about it this week in the Chicago Tribune, a fascinating story.
Thanks, Jim. Yes, indeed. Big news on the net neutrality front, which means it's going to be news that affects everyone who loves music, who makes music. Pretty much anyone who does business online is going to be affected by what is happening at the Federal Communications Commission right now. There's a new chairman appointed by Donald Trump, a Republican named Ajit Pai. What is feared is that Mr. Pai may lead a shakeup, an end to the net neutrality laws that regulate the Internet service providers.
Bring people back up to speed. What's involved?
Well, net neutrality is this concept, and it's been an issue in Washington for over a decade now, ever since the Internet really became a thing for distributing intellectual property.
Music, movies.
Exactly.
Right.
It's basically saying that the Internet should be equally accessible and open to everyone, from the smallest entities to the largest companies. And the fear is that if there wasn't a concept like net neutrality, these big users, these major companies, the Verizons of the world, the Netflix, the Amazons, will be able to pay to play, so to speak. They will be able to acquire faster speeds and broader access. And in other words, squash the little guys.
So the concept of net neutrality is that Chance the Rapper or Run the Jewels, two very successful artists who've released records on their own from their own websites, should have as much power on the net, access to as much distribution power as Sony Music.
Exactly. And it's the whole idea that an internet service provider should be a gateway to the internet rather than a gatekeeper saying who gets better access than somebody else. And Pai made some controversial comments a few weeks ago as a prelude to this appointment. He's already on record saying that he wants to, quote, fire up the weed whacker and remove those rules that are holding back investment, innovation, and creation. And a lot of people are interpreting that, because he has been a critic of the net neutrality rules that are out there, the regulations that are restricting the internet service providers. So the idea is that if net neutrality goes out the window, this level playing field will no longer be level anymore, and we'll essentially have a system that resembles the 20th century music industry in a way, this narrow pipeline of content being controlled by a few multinational corporations, you know, the Clear Channels and the Sonys, except they're now named Netflix and Verizon and Amazon. But the record company executives on these small-time labels, you know, calling them executives is a little highfalutin.
Yeah, it's a guy in his bedroom.
Regular guys and gals who are running these labels. Yeah. They're fearful of what the strike down of net neutrality will do to their future in this business.
Well, Greg, also causing some concern is a report done recently by The Hill, the newspaper that covers Congress, saying that as part of the new Trump administration's desire to eliminate $10.5 trillion in federal spending over the next decade, they are looking once again at cutting the National Endowment for the Arts. This is a drip, a little drip of water in the giant ocean of federal spending. It's a mere $150 million budget annually. Cost to Americans, 46 cents, right, from their tax dollar. You know, what are we talking about in terms of NEA funding in music? Greg, there was a fine piece in Pitchfork by Mark Hogan, who's been on our show, who notes that thousands of grants go to orchestras, jazz combos, operas, chamber music. He pointed out that the video last year of David Bowie talking about working with Lou Reed, both of those artists gone now, that was part of an NEA-funded digital archive. Esperanza Spalding, recently a guest on our show, got a grant for a performance from the Baryshnikov Arts Center in Manhattan. Not a lot of money, but sometimes it's the difference that makes these events possible or not. And apparently, Trump administration has it in its crosshairs to cut the National Endowment for the Arts. This goes back to the early 90s. The culture wars is what it's come to be called, when people like Senator Jesse Helms were offended that avant-garde, sometimes intentionally controversial artists like the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe and the performance artist Karen Finley got some national funding. Again, though, this National Endowment for the Arts, it's 0.004% of the federal budget. These are both stories, obviously, that we're going to have to stay on. Today on Sound Opinions, we are doing a show we've been meaning to get to for quite some time, a genre dissection of the sound known as krautrock. Narrowly defined, it was a movement in the very late 60s and early 70s in Germany, combining traditional rock and roll with new electronic experimentation and psychedelic exploration. We're talking really important bands here, like Kraftwerk and Can and Neu. And Greg, I don't think you could overstate the influence of these and other krautrock groups on music worldwide.
You are not kidding, Jim. Krautrock's been referenced by indie rock scenes for decades. Every band from My Bloody Valentine to Wilco's got a little krautrock in them.
Yeah.
And the roots of all electronic dance music basically can be traced back to this genre. So we're going to take a deep look at the history of the genre and its long-lasting effect on music.
Let's start with that name itself, krautrock. It is offensive if you are German, I would assume, right? It was actually coined by the English music press. The Germans in the period we're talking about preferred kosmische Musik, cosmic music. If you think about the great psychedelic explosions in the U.S., and the UK, 1966, 67 is when it goes mainstream, the Summer of Love. 68 is when it starts to be sort of a bad trip, right? The riots in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention and the riots in France, politically motivated. The psychedelic moment got to Germany a little bit later. It only really started in 1968 as opposed to the US and the UK. It was 2 or 3 years into it by that point. And the Germans, of course, put their own twist on things. This is a unique moment in German history. The new generation, mostly born post-World War II, is struggling for identity, living with the massive guilt and horrible knowledge of what had happened in the 40s in their country, looking for an alternative way to express themselves, but also one that is not too reliant on what's happening in the U.S. and the U.K. I mean, we want to be different, right? Everybody wants to be different. There's a new generation of artists across all artistic boundaries that are inventing a new world in Germany, taking their inspiration from psychedelic drugs. You have it in visual arts, performance arts. Joseph Beuys, the performance artist. In the film world, Fassbinder and Wim Wenders, and of course Werner Herzog.
Agirre will, dass die Vögel tot von den Bäumen fallen. Dann fallen die Vögel tot von den Bäumen herunter.
And then you have these cosmic music bands.
There was this manifesto that a bunch of German filmmakers came out with in 62, just as this prelude of this youth revolution was occurring in Germany. The old cinema is dead. We believe in the new cinema. Mm-hmm. And the German art rockers, which are really what krautrock is, Jim, is German art rock, they embraced that notion that all the old music is dead. We want to start something new. And when they meant old music, they were talking about even the stuff that was occurring that year in guitar-based rock and roll. They wanted to start over again.
Now, Greg, as often happens with scenes, when the press labels them with a name, these bands didn't actually have a lot in common. Some were very studious, professorial tinkerers with electronic instruments. Others were freaky hippies running around naked in the woods. Some living in communes, some living in laboratories. Some were very rock and roll, and and some were new agey. Some were psychedelic, exploring drugs, and some, seemed like mathematics professors. Now, that having been said, they do have certain things in common. They tended to work with two of the same producers, Dieter Dierks, or Conrad Planck, an interesting guy who had recorded Marlene Dietrich and Duke Ellington. There were two labels in Germany, Brain and Ohr, that put many of them out, and there were some similar touchstones. They were influenced a lot by the minimal classical musicians Terry Riley, Lamont Young, and especially their fellow German, Karlheinz Stockhausen. He was an electronic innovator, a purveyor of music concrete, the sound of industry and the street as music. And they worship this American band, the Velvet Underground. We thought the best way to give our listeners an overview of krautrock, the moment, the music, the different bands, is to look at some of the bands in depth. And, you know, quite frankly, not only is Kraftwerk the most important band in the krautrock scene, but one of the, you know, we would both say one of the most important bands in rock and roll history, period.
Oh, yeah. People have called them the Beatles of electronic music. They did for the synthesizer what Chuck Berry did for the guitar. I mean, they were that essential as a foundational element for this style of music that has flourished all around the world for subsequent decades. Kraftwerk was primarily the project of two classical music students, Ralph Hütter and Florian Schneider. In 1970, they built a studio tucked in the back of an old train station in Düsseldorf.
And the name of the studio?
Kling Klang.
Kling Klang.
Yes.
I love it.
I mean, that was the sound they wanted to make. They called romantic realism, the romance movement in classical music. They were referencing these old folk songs that the German music had been proffering for centuries and combining it with this new instrumentation and the new sound, the industrial Germany, the sound of the Autobahn, the sound of the railroad, the sound of the jets taking off.
Well,
they
eventually
wanted to combine it into their music.
I think all but the real Kraftwerk superfans, and you and I are two of those, don't realize that the band put out a couple of albums that are really pretty ordinary
right at
first. Initially, there's like flute and art rock. It's almost a little Jethro Tullish, the first two Kraftwerk albums and what they'd been before that, Organization. What would you say the classic Kraftwerk albums are, where they find their voice?
Well, you know, Autobahn was obviously the breakthrough record, highlighted by this sidelong title track, which they, you know, tongue-in-cheek said, you know, we were combining the Beach Boys with this new sound that we were coming up with.
Well, the chorus is Fahren, Fahren, Fahren under Autobahn, which is, in Germany, it's driving, driving, driving on the Autobahn, but in English, it sounds like fun, fun, fun on
right,
the Autobahn,
right,
which sounds like the Beach Boys.
Fun, fun.
So there was this combination of a sort of a tongue-in-cheek, almost bubblegum element
mm-hmm.
with this exotic sound. And apparently, you know, I was talking to the members of the group at various points in their career talking about the response from the audience when they would perform this music live for the first time. And people were hearing these sounds coming out of these massive speakers, and they didn't know how to respond. They would sit there with their mouths hanging open because it was so awesome. And how could they be making this sound from these machines? It was really dramatic. It was really powerful, and it was very new. No one had seen anything quite like it. You know, this whole idea of android culture,
yeah.
You know, that you saw in the blockbuster movies of the
80s Blade Runner,
in Hollywood,
yeah.
Blade Runner, etc. It all starts with this group, the idea that, hey, we're guys, but we're also these robots, too.
Right. Well, the wonderful pop album, The Man Machine, mm-hmm. You know, Hooter said to me, we are the men, we are the machine, the machines play us, we play the machines.
Where does humanity end and the machinery take over? What's surprising to me about that music, Jim, is out of these icy mechanical sounds, they got an incredible amount of warmth out of it. It is very warm sounding, almost soothing, deceptively soothing music at times. Beautiful music, classically oriented in many ways, and yet it's made by these machines.
From Autobahn through Trans-Europe Express, The Man Machine, Computer World, those records are all must-own for any adventurous rock fan.
After a short break, we'll continue our krautrock genre dissection with the hypnotic Motorik beat of the band Neu. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.